You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 499 of the Fabulous Felton Cast.
499.
I'm your co-host Kevin Felton, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza. I don't know if I said that.
Tristan Caracino.
And we are thrilled to be joined this week for the bulk of the podcast by our probably most third Pelton brother at this point, I guess, in terms of number of appearances on the pod.
Biologically speaking.
And just like...
That's JJ Redick.
He's the only one who's in a chat that's titled Three Pelton Brothers. So, you know, I think he's got that honor. Sorry, Zach Whitman. From rbsdm.com, please welcome back to the pod, Ben Baldwin.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back for a lot of reasons, but especially because usually at this time of year, we're winding down the Seahawks season. They just got eliminated from the playoffs. They just lost a playoff game. But no, this year, they are still alive. They will play a game in February, and of course, we're going to talk about that. So I'm very excited to be coming back in the winter with a different tenor than often.
It is very different because... Were you even listening to the pod in 2013 when the Seahawks?
No, I was not. So I was also thinking this is the first post hiatus Super Bowl appearance, right? Because they went to the back to back Super Bowls. There was a hiatus. I started listening in 2016, I think. So
right,
that was a long time ago, but not when they went to the Super Bowl.
Wow, the 2016 meme.
Everyone's been remembering 2016 on social media primarily because that's the year the Pelton Cast came back after the hiatus when we started talking again.
But can we do the intro though in full where we are? Because I also have.
What do you mean?
You're like, I'm coming to you from Boulevard Park.
Yes, I'm coming.
Or whatever, not Boulevard.
Definitely
Park.
Not coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington. That'd be fun if I was. Although I'd probably be at Jan's house, I guess. I don't know. Maybe not as fun. I'm coming to you from Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West champion Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion and Super Bowl 60. Participant Seattle Seahawks. It's also the Leonard Williams edition of the Pelton Cast in celebration of the Big Cat, the best defender on the best defense in the NFL.
Ben, do you want to weigh in on this?
Oh, I was going to say, I'm in Arlington, Virginia, where we are in day 5 of at least 9 of kids not having school because of snow. So
at least 9?
School has been canceled for tomorrow. There's no school on Friday, so that's 5 days plus 2 weekend days. Is the earliest they're going to have school again is next Monday after not having school at all this week.
How are the kids feeling about it?
They are so happy. They're 8 years old, they're like, there's nothing better than canceled school, play outside in the snow with your friends all day. They're super happy.
Do you feel like there could be a point in there where you're like, actually, this is maybe a little too much. Maybe I want to see my friends at school, but I'm glad we haven't gotten to that point yet.
No, we have not.
If we ever get there.
I should say on that, do you know where Devin Witherspoon ranks among quarterbacks PFF grade?
Number one.
That is, I really did not realize that they had Devin Witherspoon. I mean, Leonard Williams is a lowly number 11 among defensive linemen. So. And Devin Witherspoon made the play of the game, although many might be saying DeMarcus Lawrence made the play of the game on Sunday night.
I've been reading so much about this play, and I'm still not totally confident we know what happened because McVay was like, they got lucky and someone messed up. And Mike McDonald in the post game was like, we did not execute that play like we wanted to. And Witherspoon just stuck to his guy. And like some people are like, Love messed up or Lawrence made a heads up play and nobody knows like what the play call was and what the breakdown was.
I think the story we are sticking with right now is that DeMarcus Lawrence made a genius play.
And I'm happy to go with that.
DeMarcus,
it's a great story.
I mean, also the other thing is you're not the Super Bowl guy. Like, who cares? You know what I mean? Yeah. DeSean McVay.
It did have a little, and look, you, as we know, we have disagreed on this point on this podcast. It did feel a little bit like Paul George saying the Damian Lillard game winner was a bad shot.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, DeMarcus Lawrence, like, whether the play was called, I actually believe this too, right? Like, when you watch it, you could kind of see it in slow motion, like DeMarcus Lawrence making that.
Yeah, he's seen Julian Love.
I'm reading a text. Mateo's screaming upstairs. He's screaming about the dot. Hold on, let me take this phone call.
Okay.
What is going on? Why is he so upset? Because the Eagles lost in the playoffs? Because the Eagles lost in the playoffs? Okay. Okay, Saquon would bounce back next year.
How's Tay doing?
We'll find out next September.
Okay. I mean, Mina's comments on her podcast with Dominique Foxworth implied that she had talked to people within the Seahawks. So that did feel like a pretty definitive account to me. And to Tristan's point, it squares up with what we see on the play and with what McVay said. Although, like, I don't know that I would describe that as a coverage of bust, per se. Like, Lawrence wasn't supposed to be covering someone else. He was supposed to be rushing the quarterback, presumably. So,
but my anyways, answer for this is who cares? What does it matter?
I mean, it's interesting to know who to credit for the play. To your original point,
DeMarcus Lawrence will give credit for the play because he made the play. Like, I don't.
Right.
There's so much of like, well, if Mike McDonald didn't scheme it, it doesn't count. It's just like, yeah, the plays happen on the field. Sorry. I know that you want to give credit to like 40-year-old white men, but like the plays happen on the field. So
sometimes they don't want to give credit to old white men in the case of the Hall of Fame.
Well,
the other interesting part about that play is they rushed three, and one of those was rookie safety Nick Emanwori, and he, like, if somebody pressured Stafford into making the throw, it was him coming around the left tackle. It's like just amazing the different ways in which he impacted that game
in a game in which he had three pass breakups. Yeah.
No, I mean, Nick Emanwori, like, it's so funny, we talked about this after the draft where I was like, that's the player that John Schneider, that Mike McDonald wants the most in this draft. Do you remember this?
And that's why when we previewed the Seahawks before the season, we all knew that they were going to the Super Bowl this year.
There's a difference between.
I know. I'm not. Like, I'm not saying you're actually saying that. That was just a segue.
But the play. See, we didn't know about this when we did, or I didn't know about this when we did the post game pod on Sunday night. But Nick Emanwori being the one who's basically like accountability is such a strange thing. But like checking Reek Woolen on the sideline, where I was like, that is a fucking dog right there. That Nick Emanwori, out of anybody on this team, right? I think it has to come from the secondary. But like Julian Love is a very like senior member of the secondary, both in Seattle and across the NFL, right? He's an experienced player. That it's Nick Emanwori as a rookie who is the one who did it. And to me, he's the one who, like him, Spoon, people were talking about different, like this, like the MOB is from the LOB, right? Nick Emanwori and Devin Witherspoon are LOB players. You know what I mean? Like to their core. And the fact that he did that, I was like, it was impressive to me that Nick Emanwori felt that he could do that in that situation to Reek Woolen, who's been on the team for years longer than he has, but he's already a leader on the defense.
I mean, it was interesting. I saw Julian Love's post-game interview, and he was talking about basically like, look, Reek knows he screwed up. You know, you don't kind of need to
overemphasize it. There's different ways to approach it also. I'm not saying that anybody was wrong necessarily, but that was the way that Julian Love chose to approach it.
The LOB contained multitudes because, you know, Cam Chancellor wasn't the same kind of vocal leader necessarily that Richard Sherman and Earl Thomas was, but, you know, spoke volumes with his play and his dependability. So.
But the other thought that I had on that play was just like watching it as that. I can't remember. It wasn't Mumfeld, was it, who the pass was for on that fourth down play? It was the previous one that was Mumfeld.
I think it was third down.
I don't know.
Well, the third and fourth down to nameless, faceless Rams receivers. But like he had a break and Spoon saw it, right? Like Stafford wasn't a desperation throw. You know, like the decision that Stafford made, Spoon closed on that play very, very quickly. And I think he's probably underrated for his play this year, which I guess goes back to me saying Leonard Williams is the best player on the defense. But there's just when there's so many good players, it's hard to differentiate.
Mumfeld third down, Ferguson fourth down.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, but yeah, he kind of had a step on Spoon on that play and Spoon just closed it instantly.
Still just glad Terrence Ferguson made it back from that knee injury against the UW in 2023. Let's go back to, obviously the last time we had Ben on was before the season. We were previewing what to expect from the 2025 Seahawks and we had some question marks. I mean, number one, you know, let's start with this because one of the things we talked about is, The optimistic case for the Seahawks coming into the year was they were an elite defense after they added Ernest Jones midseason. And, that would carry over in year two, particularly with the additions of Emanuore and DeMarcus Lawrence. And the statistical case was, well, historically, defense is often quite unpredictable from season to season. So you shouldn't necessarily count on the Seahawks being an elite defense, even though they played at that level. And Mike McDonald has this defensive reputation. Ben, why were you wrong?
I seem to recall setting the over under for their defense in terms of DVOA at like, was
Six
it
and a
seven and a
half.
half, six and a
Yeah,
half?
something in that
And you
ballpark.
guys were like, no, that's crazy. And you at the end we all thought that was crazy. We're like, you can't put a defense over under for six and a half. So my initial instinct was right and the nerd instinct was wrong. And you can't predict defense if your head coach is Mike McDonald. I don't actually believe that. But I think so, yes, there was the optimistic case. I think they did get fortunate with injuries. Yeah, there were some guys in and out of the lineup, especially the Tampa Bay game was kind of a disaster injury-wise. But like now it's the end of the season. A lot of teams have a lot of guys out. And if you look at like the fewest games lost due to injuries, it's like the Rams and the Seahawks. And if you have a talented defense and they all stay healthy and you have a coach who's probably value add on defense, then you're probably gonna have a good defense through the course of the year.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that luck is a factor in success. Everyone who's successful gets some benefit of luck. And, health is often the key component of that in sports. And there's nothing wrong. You don't have to apologize that for that as the Seahawks, but it is a factor in it. I mean, I am curious, like, do you think it's reasonable to expect the Seahawks to be a top five defense for, the next couple of years? Or do you still believe in sort of the pull of regression to the mean at that end of the field?
Yeah, this is a good question, and I think I could talk myself into it either way. So top five is a really high standard for a defense given regression. But if you're a Seahawks fan, you also think, okay, 10 years ago they also had a very talented defense, and they were top five defense by a lot of measures for a lot of years in a row. And like throughout the season, a lot of people have scoffed at comparisons between this year's defense and the 2013 defense. And like as time goes on and the season goes on, I think those comparisons are less crazy. Although, yeah, they did get destroyed by the Rams two different times. But the rest of the games, like their playoff win over the 49ers was probably as impressive as any game that 2013 defense did, Super Bowl aside, which is a huge aside. But like a lot of the key pieces are young. Mike McDonald's going to stick around and like, other than the games against the Rams, I think they do have a shot to be a good defense for a while going forward if guys stay healthy, and that's like the one thing you can't ever predict in the NFL.
Oh, I
I
love
love
Tristan Poppy up there.
Just when we talked on the post game pod, like the Rams are more likely to get worse at offense than the Seahawks defense is likely to get worse. So if our only concern is the Rams, granted that's going to be a first place schedule after this, but like, and we don't, it's impossible year over year to actually predict strength of schedule in the NFL, but they will have a first place schedule. It's just hard for me to see. I mean, like DeMarcus Lawrence is not young necessarily. Leonard Williams is not young necessarily. But I think the most impressive thing that Mike McDonald did, granted, every coach needs good players, and no matter who they are, and Mike McDonald has good players on this defense. And part of that is him like helping to draft those players, guiding them who to draft in the way that I was talking about Nicky Emanuore. Obviously, John Schneider is into it too. Drake Thomas is a key part of this defense. Ty Okada played really well. Josh Jobe is a key part of this defense. Kobe Bryant is a big part of this defense. Like, yes, there are higher drafted names. I think that was a Mike Shon thing where he was talking about how like a lot of these players have been highly on this current iteration of the Seahawks defense have been highly drafted or highly recruited. It's been different than the chip on their shoulder LOB defense. But it's almost like granted, the team is going to get more expensive. We're not really in that same situation as the early Russ years, where it was like cheap quarterback, extraordinarily young, extraordinarily cheap defense. Like Spoon is still a top five pick. Nicky Emanuore is the top of the second round. They're not dirt cheap in the way that some of those players were beforehand. But I think ultimately the most impressive thing that Mike McDonald did was Ernest Jones was somebody who the Rams let walk in free agency, and then they traded for a fourth round pick, fifth round pick.
I think it was fifth. or later.
Like they traded for a later round pick. It wasn't like Ernest Jones the fourth was a player that was teams were desperate to have. Mike Macdonald made him that player, and Ernest Jones obviously also, but there's a little bit of like these players in a different situation, a different scheme may not seem as valuable.
I'm curious about this Rams offense take, and this doesn't need to be a Rams podcast, but Sean McVay's been there for almost 10 years. They've had really good offense for almost that entire time, so I'm a little skeptical about them suddenly being not good.
I'm not saying that they're not going to be good, but it's not easy to replace. Like Jared Goff was underrated as Rams quarterback, which is pretty clear at this point, yep. Right? Like Jared Goff has been successful, yep. And Jared Goff has been successful past the Rams. So he was the number one fucking pick of the draft. Literally both of the quarterbacks that Sean McVay has had have been the number one pick of the draft.
True.
And it's not an easy thing to replace. And also in a quarterback as they're getting older, like Matt Stafford had a couple of scrambles for first downs in that game. I was a little shocked by. I think he.
You know who else was shocked by them? Matt Stafford.
DeMarcus Lawrence. Oh.
No, they broke a DeMarcus Lawrence tackle. It's not gonna stay as easy as it was for, like, I don't know. Stafford had a good season, but if you are judging the best season that a quarterback has had in their entire career at 37 and expecting that to be a new baseline, then get your hopes up. I get
this is your new catchphrase.
No, it's a good one. But
until it gets used on you.
That's fine. But you understand what I'm saying? Like I don't
Jed,
think that,
Jed Fish, get your hopes up.
Hey, first off, I will have and will. but does that make sense? Like it's not necessarily like Sean McVay has been dealing with an incredible amount of talent. And yep. Yes, they turned it over. Like their defense, there were questions about a couple of years ago, and maybe the defensive turnaround was impressive, but offensively, it's still fucking Matt Stafford. You know what I mean? Like it's not like they've been devoid of talent. They have Devontae Adams and Puka Nacua.
I mean, I guess I would say that's the difference maybe between McVay and Shanahan, where McVay doesn't have like sort of the track record of, you know, doing it with a variety of different players. It has been, as you noted, Goff, huge prospect, struggled his first year, but, you know, was generally successful under McVay, and then handpicked, you know, yep. Tape God quarterback that they went out and got. So, you know, they had their moments with whoever the guy was who started the playoff game against the Seahawks, but it was not
Wolford.
Yeah.
It was not Brock Purdy coming out of nowhere to be one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL, yep. Until he faced the Seattle Seahawks
for
defense.
9 years. And Kyle Shanahan's winning percentage is 55%. Not bad, right? A respectable 55% with two Super Bowl appearances. Sean McVay is 61.7%, almost 6. Sean McVay is a better coach than Kyle Shanahan. There's almost no way to, and he has a Super Bowl championship, and they both have two Super Bowl appearances. Like, Sean McVay has probably done more with less than what Kyle Shanahan has done.
I don't know. That's a debate for a different pod. When we start our NFC West spinoff pod, we'll come back to that. Seahawks offense. We were somewhat skeptical, I would say, coming into this year, although, you know, hopeful as well. But the biggest question was just like, how much skill position talent is there on this team? I mean, you go back to, this was a point that I was hammering for a period of time. You know, you look at like ESPN's preseason top 10 list by position, and the Seahawks just didn't have that many players on those lists. And to the extent that they did this year, that was primarily on defense. And then for JSN, who, you know, was obviously the most talented player to blow up the way that he has, for Sam Darnold to have the season, and particularly the first half that he did, and then maybe for, to a lesser degree, for the run game to come together the way that it has the final few weeks of the regular season and then on into the playoffs, like, how surprised were you by that, Ben?
Extremely surprised. And I remember some of us had takes about Cooper Kupp too that I'm assuming Tristan will bring up at some point. But
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, maybe he was a little more useful than Tyler Lockett in the end. So on Kupp in particular, like there were stretches of the season where he was almost an afterthought. And this is especially before Torrey Horton got hurt, who Who knows what the offense would have looked like the second half of the season if he hadn't gotten hurt? He looked like definitely a useful piece in the Seahawks offense, but Cooper Kupp definitely saved the Seahawks multiple times. So, like, yeah, maybe they paid a lot of money for him, but if you make the Super Bowl, it's hard to raise too many question marks afterwards. And the offense as a whole, the first half of the season, they were top three at worst by a lot of measures, I think. And they really tapered off in the second half of the season, but against the Rams, against the 49ers, when it really mattered, Sam Darnold, JSN, Kenneth Walker, all these guys really stepped up, and it was just barely enough to get it done. And here we are.
Do you buy the idea that the Seahawks sort of, knowing how well the defense was playing in the second half of the season, knowing the turnover issues that they had in the first half of the season, that they sort of intentionally backed off the gas? And do you feel like that is supported by the offense that we did see from them in the playoffs?
I think that's possible, and it's hard to know like how much of this is coaching, how much of this is Sam Darnold like really not wanting to turn the ball over after that first Rams game. And it's funny because this is so much like the conversation during it was the 2020 season, right? The Let Russ Cook season, where they came out on fire. Wilson had some turnovers in the middle of the season, and then the last like half of the season they played a bunch of bad teams and they just
Pete
let their
fixed it.
defense, shoddy fix it, made cut down on the turnovers. But in that season, that loss to the Giants kicked them out of the first round bye, and obviously the season ended very poorly. This time they didn't lose, even though they were conservative, and maybe that could have been the Colts game where they lost their first round bye, but they ended up hanging on in the end. And I was so encouraged by how aggressive they were at the end of this last game. I think you guys touched on this too, but they did not run pass every single sequence, needing to drain 5 minutes from the clock, and it probably would have ended poorly if they had done that. But they came out throwing on second down in all of the series, or almost all of the series, and I think that is what really won the game for them in the end.
Which then sort of segues to an interesting question about whether we think they'll go back conservative to a degree in the Super Bowl, knowing that they are not facing a Rams offense all of a sudden, even though Drake May is the leading contender for MVP over Matthew Stafford.
Yeah, it's definitely a thought that's been in the back of my mind, and hoping that like they saw what works, they saw what the offense can do, and hopefully they look at the body of work as a whole as a Patriots and see that they can score, that Drake May was very effective as a quarterback, and that the Seahawks really might need to put up points in the Super Bowl to win.
From a big picture standpoint, like I don't know that you've looked at like specifically how important is turnover rate in the NFL, but it does feel like maybe there's a little bit less importance placed on it now. And I guess I'm curious sort of how that relates to the increased aggressiveness of the league on fourth downs and kind of the recognition that, a punt is a turnover. That sort of logic is catching hold to a greater degree, I think, among coaches.
Yeah, I don't know the specific answer to this question. I definitely think like the average fan or pundit definitely overrates turnovers. And like a big example of this was after the Bills game, where yes, they turned the ball over five times or whatever, and that's bad. But on all their other drives, or almost all their other drives, they scored. So the question is like, would you rather score 30 points and turn the ball over five times, or score 10 points and not turn the ball over? And I think the answer to that is pretty obvious, but it's not exactly. Like if you're a quarterback or a coach, how do you correctly calibrate the trade-off between scoring points and avoiding turnovers? And I think that is where it gets tricky, and that's where like maybe the Seahawks got a little bit conservative at points in the second half of the season and went back to being good in the playoffs.
Letting it rip. I mean,
Yeah.
some of the balls that Darnold threw against the Niners, and a couple of ones against the Rams, certainly. Like,
Were there any games in particular that we're thinking of that, I mean, like
oh, the Colts game for
Oh
sure, the Vikings
yeah.
game. I mean, they still won the Vikings game is such an The
extreme
question
outlier.
isn't whether they
For,
won the
first off,
game or not.
I think that Vikings defense finished like they finished the season extraordinarily strong.
They were number two over the second half of the season behind the Seahawks, yes, and not that far.
Like the first half of the Panthers game, the first half of the Falcons game, like there were a lot of huge chunks of games where the offense didn't really do anything.
These are still games that they're winning by like 17 and 18 points. So it's hard to nitpick that much, I guess is what I'll say.
I mean, but it's also the kind of thing where, you know, if they had struggled to keep up with the Rams offensively, you would be looking back and saying, well, yeah, that was obvious. Like they weren't playing well offensively for the entire second half of the season. So
But they didn't.
I know, but you didn't know that at the time. I think it was a fair question to ask.
I guess I don't think it's a fair question to ask now because we do have the
But I, well, I
like
think
the
it's a fair
Rams game in
question to
particular.
ask whether they would go back to that conservative style against the Patriots.
It's the Super Bowl. Like I would be very surprised. I think are we gonna like turn toward the Super Bowl? Or are we still talking
Yeah.
about
Yeah,
the
we can turn
offseason
to
in
it.
general? And I've been going back and forth on this perspective, and I'm curious to hear what you think also, Ben, of like the spread started almost exactly the same. Kevin and I were talking before the NFC Championship game, and he said that the spread would be a touchdown no matter who it was between these two teams, whether the Seahawks or the Rams won.
Mistakes were made.
Which no, but I it didn't it wasn't a shocking thing for you to say in that moment. But then at the same time, we see that the Patriots are number two in weighted DVOA, that by a lot of metrics, Drake May is the best quarterback in the NFL, better than Stafford. And especially your metrics, EPA is phenomenal, right? Like the EPA plus CPOE is also phenomenal. Like Stafford's fourth or fifth in that. Granted, the Seahawks also shut down Brock Purdy, who's kind of number two in it. So it's a little bit hard to understand if basically like Stafford, if Sean McVay and Stafford just understand the Seahawks defense at such a fundamental level that they're the only people who are going to be good against it. Because so far this year, aside from Baker Mayfield, that's kind of been true. So I went into like basically looking back at the Patriots game with kind of the hypothesis of the Patriots are better than the Rams are. And breaking down each of these individual games, I left it with the perspective of I don't really think that's the case. I still think that the Rams are a better team than the Rams had some kind of against the Seahawks. I think the Rams are, for whatever reason, so well positioned to play against this Seahawks team, and that offense is so well positioned to play against the Seahawks team that I would probably not assume that anybody else in the league, Drake May or not, is in that same situation. And same with Josh McDaniels, Mike Vrabel.
Yeah, I think we've known for a long time the NFC is the better conference. So whoever, unless something crazy happened in the NFC playoffs, then whoever won the NFC was going to be healthily favored against whoever won the AFC. And we're seeing that now. I think it's like maybe 2/3 or something percent chance of victory that the Seahawks have. Last time I checked, which seems reasonable. It's like in between the Rams and 49ers games in terms of difficulty. Yeah, it's hard to make a case that the Patriots are as good as the Rams in a vacuum, and also especially against the Seahawks. And the Rams play the Seahawks close three different times. I think they're probably about as good as each other, and those are the two best teams in the NFL, which doesn't mean the Seahawks are guaranteed to win, but they should be favored, and they are favored.
Yeah, I mean, the other factor there, obviously, you don't have the benefit of home field in the Super Bowl in the same way that you do. I mean, Tristan mentioned this, the Patriots up to number two in weighted DVOA. It's 68% implied odds at the moment based on DraftKings. So Aaron Schatz posted this on Blue Sky. The Patriots have the biggest difference of any playoff team in NFL history between their weighted DVOA and their total DVOA, because of the difference between how they started the year and how they ended it, starting it with obviously a loss to the Las Vegas Ravens, who would go on to go 2-14 over their next 16 games. And that was a win in their final week. So they lost 14 of their next 15 games, beating only the Titans in that span. That truly goes back in hindsight as one of the most shocking outcomes in NFL history, I would have to say. And not just to the Raiders, at home to the Raiders.
And it's so hard to know what to make of the weighted versus unweighted DVOA difference, because so much of this is just crushing either teams that are playing a backup quarterback or a bad quarterback or a quarterback playing in a snowstorm. So like it's really hard given the sample size of the NFL, like how do we extrapolate the Patriots' performance against these teams that don't necessarily have good offenses? And the one really impressive performance was their wild card game against the Chargers and Justin Herbert. And as good as Justin Herbert is, that offense is not, they're not even like a top half offense this year. So yes, they completely shut them down, but it's not the same as like what the Seahawks did to the 49ers, for example. And on the offensive side of the ball, the Patriots have really fallen off a cliff. But again, it's hard to know how much of that is because they played better defenses, how much of that is because they knew they didn't need to score that many points to win the game, how much of that is because they played in 1.5 snowstorms. And it's just like it seems more unpredictable than a typical Super Bowl might be.
There are some Seahawks Patriots, parallels in that regard, with the defenses playing better in the second half of the season, the offenses, not playing as well, and trying to understand, what happens when they feel like they need to. So, yeah, I mean, I think for a long period of time, I would probably summarize your thinking is that defense is more a thing that happens, or a like. Your defensive results are more a thing that happens to you and are a product of the schedule that you play than your own performance. Are you still of that mindset?
I think, yeah, primarily it's who you play. And we've seen an example of this with the Seahawks, where they are a great defense. They should be credited as a great defense. But when they go against the Rams, then like the offense matters a lot in what happens. Although it's not a blanket statement because the 49ers also have a really good offense, and the Seahawks defense did just fine against them for 120 minutes in a row. But yeah, I think any defensive results should be taken with a grain of salt, especially when you're playing backup quarterbacks, because it's really hard to adjust for that. Like for example, DVOA is great; it's a really good measure of defense. But when you adjust DVOA, you're making adjustments. You're saying, okay, they played against the Ravens, so we'll make this adjustment. But it doesn't know that it's not the Ravens with Lamar Jackson; it's the Ravens with Tyler Huntley for some games, or it's the Dolphins without Tua, or I guess all the Browns quarterbacks are bad, but or the Broncos without Bo Nix for the whole game. So I think it is possible that even opponent adjusted stuff can be under adjusted if you're playing against a lot of backup quarterbacks, which to be fair is true of both defenses. So there's only so far we can take this line of thinking, but I think it does matter a little bit.
It certainly is a case for taking the over, I suppose, in the Super Bowl. Yeah, of the final six games they played in the regular season, the Patriots, to your point, faced 3.5 or four backup quarterbacks, depending on how you characterize the Huntley game. So, and one of those being Brady Cook, and another of those being Quinn Ewers.
In the
So,
game against not a backup quarterback, Josh Allen, the Bills did very well on offense.
right. And that was the game. That was an interesting game because in the first half of that game, particularly given all of that context, the Patriots come in 11-2. I think they had a chance to clinch the division had they won that game, as I recall from watching it. And in the first half, they really were struggling badly. I'm sorry, in the first half, they were dominant. It was like, okay, this is oh, they are not a fraud. And then Buffalo came back as dramatically as it did. It was like, oh, a fraud's watch back on. And I still don't know where we're at in terms of Patriots frauds, but I have to respect the weighted DVOA to a degree. And look, they got here. Like,
But also, I think offensively, like, yes, they were playing those backup quarterbacks, but I might have talked myself back into the Patriots are a better team than the Rams. But like, they were playing those backup quarterbacks, but it's really their offense ultimately that we're talking about in a lot of these games. And in that game against Buffalo, it is 7.5 yards per play for the Patriots. Not a great Buffalo defense by any means. There was, I think, weather was a factor in that game too. But they did outgain the Bills by 2.3 yards per play in that game. And Josh Allen went and won the game overall. But like the points that they scored, you still need to score points against bad teams. And there are other bad teams who didn't score points against those teams. They did finish the season with like, the lowest amount that they scored was, I guess, and even the second half of the season was 24 against the Falcons. Like the Patriots, the offense, and they led the league in EPA per play, right? The Patriots offense. So it's probably not statistically the best offense that they'll have faced all year, but the difference between them and the Rams, how great is it actually significant? Like, is it a significant difference?
I think one of my questions is part of the reason the Rams are so scary is because of Puka Nacua and Davante Adams, and it's just really hard to match up with them, especially with how Sean McVay uses them. And maybe this is like a homer take and it'll look dumb, but I'm wondering if, given the talent the Patriots have at receiver, if they can really consistently move the ball on a defense like the Seahawks defense. And I'm not sure that they've been able to do that.
Is Drake May possibly the best rushing quarterback that the Seahawks have faced all year?
I think that's possibly true. I was looking at this earlier today. It depends on what you think about the 2025 versions of Kyler Murray, Jaden Daniels, Cam Ward, and even Trevor Lawrence rushes a little bit. But I would say he probably is. On the ESPN QBR page, no quarterback has added more expected points in the postseason with his legs than Drake May. So it's definitely a unique threat, especially compared to the games against the Rams that the Seahawks have been playing.
One of the things I'm interested in, another element of the way that the Rams schemed against the Seahawks was a lot of multiple tight end formations in those matchups. And the Patriots do that to a degree. They've got Hunter Henry and Austin Hooper. But the other thing they do is like use six offensive linemen. And that's not really a strategy we've seen much against the Seahawks. And I'm curious, like, can you create those same kind of favorable matchups for your wide receivers if they don't respect the tight end who's actually an offensive lineman? Is a pass threat, a pass catching threat? Is it a situation where the Patriots throw the six offensive linemen a ball at some point in the Super Bowl to try to catch the Seahawks off guard? That to me is going to be a fascinating thing to watch because I think it's key to what McVay was able to do. Yeah, I mean, the Patriots are just the fun thing about the Super Bowl is like, is. As interesting as it is to play the Rams three times in, 3 months or whatever it was, the Niners two times in 3 weeks. This is just like such a stylistically different game and a game that there's no real history between these two versions. Obviously, there's a lot of history between the Seahawks and the Patriots in the Super Bowl, but it doesn't involve any of these guys.
Can you imagine at the end of last year's Seahawks Patriots game, you'd be like, these teams are going to play in the Super Bowl next year?
Not really. Anything else stand out to you that you're sort of watching going into this matchup?
I think that mostly covers it. I've seen a lot about the Patriots interior pass rushers. Maybe that's like one thing that sort of concerns me about this game is how well the interior of Seattle's line will hold up if the Seahawks actually try to pass the ball.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah, what else are you sort of stands out about the Patriots defense and the success they've had against these backup quarterbacks and then in the favorable conditions in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think that's the main thing. It's just like the quarterback pressure from the interior, and Anthony Bradford has definitely been a weak point on the offensive line at times. So I guess just like the hope is they just don't get overwhelmed from the interior from that standpoint.
They've got Christian Gonzalez is an elite corner. But not someone who apparently travels necessarily with number one receivers on a consistent basis. I mean, maybe if you're going to do that, the Super Bowl with 2 weeks to prepare is the time to do it. And then, it's a matter of sort of one of the things that I've really enjoyed late in the season is the way that Clint Kubiak has been creative, whether it's JSN in the backfield or whatever, to try to generate favorable matchups against defenses that are locked in on taking him away and still make him, certainly in the NFC Championship game, a big part of the offense.
This is one thing Aaron noted in the pre-preview is that the
Yep.
Patriots are the second worst team against number one receivers by DVOA. So fingers crossed there.
Yeah, that's I like Christian Gonzalez. Like, I again, PFF grade is not everything, but we talked about Devin Witherspoon being ranked first. He ranks 43rd.
Interesting.
And they're not comparable in that same way as far as like elite receivers. And the defense isn't comparable either, right? Like, I think it's a similar situation where we're talking about where the Seahawks defense is the best in the league. They're the best in the league by almost any metric, but by EPA especially. The Patriots are fine. They're not a great defense, but they're a good enough defense. Their offense has been excellent. It's a little bit difficult to adjust for it. And I think that's kind of what we're getting to is basically like without having played against elite teams and having played badly in two of their three playoff games, their offense, it's a little bit of like prove it to me, basically. And that's the situation that the Patriots are in. And that's why this game is a little bit hard to understand because it would be very easy to look at it and say this team has not played well. And granted, weather's been a factor, but other teams have played in weather, and you know, like the weather wasn't that bad, right? It wasn't the Rams,
the first half
Bears
weather
game.
Wasn't that bad. I mean, it was interesting. Nate Silver's analysis using his Qbert metric suggested that May actually had the best game of any of the quarterbacks on Sunday once you accounted for the weather and the Denver defense that they were going up against. And then the value that he creates, you know, as a runner, I do think that sometimes is almost kind of invisible to a degree compared to, you know, what Stafford does as a passer.
That is the only piece, basically, which first off, I'm like, it's a little bit of kind of maybe there's glitches in the computer here, that the quarterback who threw for 86 yards and got sacked 5 times and completed 10 passes had a better game than Stafford. The game that Stafford had, factoring in the Seahawks defense, like, you're giving weather too much of a credit there.
Do you guys put any stock in the argument of Mike Vrabel's been there before, Josh McDaniels has been there before, they know all the Super Bowl week prep, they're going to be more prepared and ready to go on during on the game?
Has Mike Vrabel been there before? I mean, like, as a head coach? Because that was another thing that I looked at, which was basically...
Well, he's not been there as a head coach.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. But as a head coach, I was looking at it of like, could this be a close game because Mike Vrabel... Like, he just plays close games in the playoffs in particular. And yeah. I went and looked back at the Titans, and 2 years in a row, the last two times they made the playoffs with the Titans, the first time they made the playoffs, they were 2-1. They lost in the AFC championship game. And they had a couple of road wins, but they lost 2 home games in his second 2 appearances in the playoffs. And he was 0-1 both times. They lost by about a touchdown. I think it was a Ravens game and maybe
is the Bengals. The Titans were the one seed and lost to the Burrow Bengals that went to the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's nothing in Mike Vrabel's history aside from this one playoff run that is what Mike McDonald has done this first year, having beaten the Niners by the margin that he beat the Niners and having beaten the Rams, who, again, like, all the statistics aside, Vegas definitely thought was the second best team at the very least in the NFL.
I mean, I wouldn't say statistics aside, they are still number two and historically good by DVOA. They just, yes. Their weighted DVOA wasn't quite as good. And the weighted DVOA says more about the Patriots than it says about the Rams.
So it's what Mike McDonald has done in those 2 games is more impressive than anything Mike Vrabel has done. If anything, right, that's part of the reason he was fired by the Titans, were losses like that game that you're talking about as the number one seed losing to the Bengals. So I really don't buy that have the been here before. To me, if anything, on a timing of being there, like, organizationally, everything about the Seahawks organization feels been there before. And it's true of the Patriots also, right? But it if anything, timing-wise, it feels like we're a year too early on Drake May. This is not the Super Bowl that the Patriots are supposed to be in.
That is something I was curious about. Like, I've done, you know, a fair bit of research into, like, the idea, the value of experience in the playoffs in the NBA, and it's real. Like, it does exist. And I, you know, have a variety of different theories. I don't think it's just about, like, having been there before. It's also, there's no back-to-backs. And I think back-to-backs tend to affect older players differently than they do younger players. And so that sort of element isn't really comparable to football. But, like, is there evidence that experience matters for quarterbacks in particular in the playoffs?
I don't know. And these questions, I'm sure you've looked at this at NBA too, but these questions are so hard to answer too, because, like, experienced players... If you stick around, you stick around because you're good. So are you, yes, like, are you winning when you're older because you're good, or are you winning because of the experience you accrued? And it's, like, a little bit hard to separate those kind of things.
Well, even who has the advantage? Like, I think literally Sam Darnold and Drake May have started the same amount of playoff games because Sam Darnold started one last year and the Patriots played one more this year.
That is kind of funny.
Right? Isn't that, I think that's it. But granted, yeah, Sam Darnold is a much more experienced quarterback overall than Drake
it has been to a Super Bowl. Yes, he is happily pointed that buzz game.
Yeah,
never forget Sam Darnold.
I really don't buy the Josh McDaniels and Mike Vrabel. However, here's what I think. I think this will be a close game. Like, I think it is similar to the. I actually don't think there's almost any world that the Seahawks blow out the Patriots in it.
Well,
I would
think
be pretty surprised
if the Seahawks blow out the Patriots.
If there's turnovers or special teams things.
I mean, I guess it could be similar to the Rams game, where it's basically like either the Seahawks are going to blow them out or it's going to be close. I think this feels like a Seahawks game from 2025. And it's basically arm's length the whole time. The Seahawks get out to an early lead. Their defense makes a few stops. And then it's maybe one of these. We played so many fake close games, right? This year that never were actually that close. That to me is what this one feels like. The Patriots are a good enough team and a good enough offense and even organizationally good enough to keep it to that place where it's like they're always going to be in it. But in the end, the Seahawks are just a better team. And that's what Vegas is picking up on, right? The line started at 3.5. It moved to 4.5 within a day. And obviously, you know, people who are betting early on it were betting heavily on the Seahawks because of that, because they're not, you know, they're not wanting to move the line necessarily.
I saw this was like Monday. I thought that it was like 79% of bets had
given
on
the
Seahawks.
I mean, I was genuinely shocked when I saw it at 3.5 to begin with, because we'd talked about that and I thought it would be closer to 4.5, 5. And I do wonder if these two teams played, granted there's no neutral site games during the regular season. Well, I guess there are, but like if these two teams played a neutral site regular season game, I think the Seahawks would be favored by more. I think because it's the Super Bowl, they set it a little bit closer.
That's probably true.
And the Patriots are a little bit of a public team.
The NFL is definitely ready for a lot of neutral site games during the regular season, many more. So percentage chances of victory?
I really just don't think the Patriots are ready for this game. And I think we have not seen any offense move the ball that effectively against the Seahawks defense, aside from Sean McVay's Los Angeles Rams. And they've done it twice. And it's been impressive, you know, and maybe they'd have done it a third time had it not been for the turnovers early, right? I was shocked that it happened for a second time on Sunday because I didn't think it could happen in this defense. However, it takes a very specific set of offensive, I guess I'll say genius in this case, to have been able to have done that. And I try it with Josh McDaniels and Drake May because I think the Seahawks defense is just too good. The offense, when you look at them weighted unit, you know, units wise, Seahawks defense is obviously the best unit on the field. And we haven't talked about special teams.
Definitely an advantage for the Seahawks.
Another advantage for the Seahawks across the board. Like the Patriots offense is better than the Seahawks offense, but the margin of the Seahawks defense is better than the Patriots. This feels a little bit like Super Bowl 48 to me. And that Broncos offense was probably better than this Patriots offense is. So
How you went from you can't see a blowout to Super Bowl 48.
Well, I actually don't think it's going to be a blowout. I think the Patriots are going to be in this game, but I think the Seahawks are going to win the game. And I'll put it at, I want to say 70%.
Okay. Ben?
As Kevin said, market's at 68, and I was going to say, I'm going to force myself to be a little bit more optimistic than market and say 70%, and that was exactly what I thought in my head before Tristan said 70%, so wow. We're in the same place.
I also thought 70%.
Wow.
we're higher than the statistical models here. DVOA has the Seahawks at 60%, FPI, which has generally been a little low because of their low starting point based on the over-under total, which we'll talk about in a second, also around 60%, but yeah, I mean, I don't think that Vegas is overrating the Seahawks here. I think they're rating them. So.
I think Vegas was underrating the Seahawks. I mean, they came out underrating the Seahawks.
Well, yeah, but I think they caught up at some point here.
Is this a 4.5-point game?
But I guess the money line is more telling here than the spread itself might be, I guess, would be my point.
I mean, the Patriots aren't just happy to be there because they're the Patriots. If the Patriots were any other organization, they'd just be happy to be here with the season that they had. And that's kind of, and again, Drake May is a good quarterback, but I look back at a lot of these performances and I don't know if he's being overrated because of the rushing, but there are a lot of games where I'm just like, they're not great overall. There's a lot of games that he played this season where it's like, you know, 23-45. And you just can't do that against the Seahawks team. You have to be elite or be able to hit the big plays that the Rams were able to, which again, like if your goal is to hit big plays against the Seahawks defense, my advice is to get your hopes up because.
Or get Sean McVay.
Honestly, if they had Sean McVay, who knows? Maybe this would be a different game. But like, and if the Seahawks and the Rams played again, maybe this would be a different game. I don't think we can leave that game last week and say to ourselves, there was a mandate on the Seahawks necessarily, but they won the game and they played very good. Sam Darnold played very good. And this defense is an elite defense. Same with the special teams across the board.
I was looking at past Seahawks games to see the game with closest market implied percent chance of winning. And when they went and played the Panthers, they had an estimated 73% chance of winning. So they're in the Super Bowl with almost as good of a chance of winning as at the Carolina Panthers. It's not a guarantee, but it's a pretty crazy place to be given expectations before the season.
And very different than Super Bowls 48 and 49 or 40. Like the idea of the Seahawks as prohibited favorites in the Super Bowl is a new and in some ways terrifying one. Well, you know what else is terrifying?
But they also, I guess, one last point here, like point differential statistically, everything about the Seahawks team has been the best this season. But even with the schedule that we talked about, granted, the Seahawks didn't play the hardest schedule, but they still played four times against the Rams and the Niners. The Seahawks were number one
six
in point
times.
Differential. Oh, I guess that's true. Yes, they played six times. I don't know if point differential counts the playoffs, I guess. But even with the schedule.
I mean, it can. It's possible.
It would be even better if it counted the playoffs. So just how much better they were. And when you look at the Patriots, they played the Bills two times. That's it. And the Seahawks had a better point differential for the season without the benefit of playing the Dolphins and the Jets and crushing teams like that. It's same with the Browns and the Raiders. Like it is a factor when you scroll back, and it's a little shocking how these performances went and the quarterbacks that they played. Granted, the Seahawks played Max Brosmer, but they still played a lot of
Philip
teams.
Rivers, his first football game in 5 years or whatever it was.
It's kind of like the only card that's not on the Patriots bingo, though, is playing Phil Rivers. You still said Brady. Like, I would probably take that Phil Rivers game over.
I would agree.
Quinn Ewers' first game ever, or Brady Cook. Maybe that was Quinn Ewers' second game ever. Sorry. But, like, the amount of just looking back through the teams, it's shocking how you could end up with a schedule like this. So, and the Seahawks crushed their schedule and played good teams across the board. Like, are the Patriots that much better than the Texans? I'm not convinced of that. Or the Patriots that much better than the Niners? I'm also not convinced of that.
How much would you trade to be in the AFC East going forward?
This is fun. That's the point. Who cares? There's nothing fun about playing good teams is fun. It was fun to have played Sean McVay. Having Sean McVay
beating
good team
is fun.
Yeah.
It's also fun losing to good teams.
Can be.
We should deliver one Terrence Ferguson retire bitch after that play. Maybe actually should.
Well, you know what else is terrifying? Besides the NFC West. Looking back on our season-long over-unders, which has historically been a pretty fruitful exercise for us, particularly for Ben, not so much in 2025 season. So per tradition, we usually, as Ben's noted, are doing this shortly after the regular season because the Seahawks season is already over. We've gone a little longer this time, so I compiled these a while back. Arizona Cardinals had a line of 8.5 wins. Tristan was over that. Ben and I were under. They won three games. Atlanta Falcons had a line of 7.5 wins. We were all over. We were all on the Michael Penix Jr. hype train, and we rode it all the way to Kirk Cousins finishing out the season with 8 wins. So we hit on that one.
We got that one?
We got that one. Enjoy it while it lasts.
I was nervous there for a second.
Baltimore Ravens.
Bad?
It wasn't good. Baltimore Ravens had a line of 11.5 wins. We were all over on that. They won 8 games. Although point differential of a solid, like, what, 10-win team probably at least. Buffalo Bills had a line of 11.5 wins. We were all over on that. We managed that one as they won 12 games. Carolina Panthers had a line of 6.5. Ben and I were both under on the Panthers. We did not believe in the Skeptics. Bryce Gongasance. Tristan was over. They won 8 games. Chicago Bears had a line of 8.5 wins. Unprecedented Bears preseason hype. Everyone was feeling so good, but not us. As we were all under on the Bears, and I made it a lock.
Wow.
I made it a lock.
They had
Bears
the third best point differential in their division.
The Bears won 11 games. Was it? It wasn't negative though, was it? Like they were.
No, it was, they were plus 26.
Yeah,
it was for almost the entire season, and then wasn't at the end.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll take the process victory on that then. Cincinnati Bengals had a line of 9.5 wins. What could possibly go wrong? We were all over. They won six games. Cleveland Browns had a line of 4.5 wins. We were all under on that one. What could possibly go right? Somehow Cleveland won five games and hit their
I
over.
still don't really. It did require winning the last 2 weeks of the year. They had to beat the Steelers to keep the Steelers out of the playoffs for one of those.
They may have spiritually been under. I mean, their defense wasn't though. Let me give that credit. Dallas Cowboys had a line of 7.5 wins. The statistics community always
How
high
did
on
they
the
not go
Cowboys.
over?
Both Ben and I were over. Tristan, you were the un under here,
I
and
was
you were
under.
correct
I'm
if they finished with
shocked that I
seven
didn't
wins.
pick them over, and I'm shocked they didn't get to eight wins.
All truly
It doesn't
shocking.
make sense. The Cowboys played like an eight-win team this year, right?
They got to 7.5.
Yes, you don't get to count that one in the standings, alas. The Cowboys are, the Chargers were once this, I think, for a lot of people, particularly like the tape community. The Cowboys are like the fool us, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me 17 times, shame on me. And
I
yet,
know there's one that I said this is finally the year it doesn't happen, and it happened coming up.
Denver had a line of 9.5 wins. Ben and I were both under on that. How could a Bo Nix team win double-digit games? Tristan did go over, and they won 14 games,
Wow.
obviously. Detroit had a line of 10.5 wins. We were all over on that. They won nine games, although that's another one process-wise. They probably
Yeah.
should have won considerably more.
Plus 68 point differential.
Green Bay had a line of 9.5 wins. We were all over. Ben made this a lock. And was probably feeling good about this much of the season before they won, finished with nine wins after Micah Parsons' ACL injury and went under. Houston Texans had a line of 9.5 wins. Ben and I were under on this one. Tristan was not only over, but made it a lock.
There we
And
go.
that is our first winning lock, is they got to 12 wins.
I was that hyped on the Texans. See, I've been riding this Texans train all season, apparently.
You clearly have, yes. Even before you saw them in person. The
I
Indiana,
did
oh, I guess
not
you
see them in
didn't see them
person.
in person. Yes, I remembered. Indianapolis Colts, you were in proximity to them. Indianapolis Colts had a line of 7.5 wins. I guess you weren't at the Mariners game. You were watching it at home.
I was not. That would have been in Toronto.
I sometimes I gotta think through the jokes. Indianapolis Colts had a line of 7.5 wins. Tristan and I were both under. Ben was over on this one, able to take an early victory lap because they clinched this in like week 13 by getting to their eighth win or 14 or whatever this was. And then they stayed put at eight wins during the Phillip Rivers era. Jacksonville Jaguars, a line of 7.5 wins. We were all over on this one and they won 13 games. Let's go. Kansas City Chiefs, a line of 11.5 wins. Ben was over. Tristan and I were under on this one. Obviously, their luck turned the Patrick Mahomes injury. They finish with six wins. Las Vegas Raiders,
Oh, God.
line of 6.5 wins. In Pete, we trust. Over, we all went. In Geno, I made this my other lock.
Oh, God.
Raiders over. They went 3-14 and
I
secured the number one pick in the
swear I remember
draft.
being negative on the Raiders going into the season.
No, because it'd been so long since Pete Carroll had actively coached a game. And it's always fun to root for Pete when he's not actively coaching a game. Even when he's making correct fourth down decisions. Being bullied into making correct fourth down decisions at that. Los Angeles Chargers had a line of 9.5 wins. Ben went under on this one. Tristan and I were over. They won 11. Los Angeles Rams, line of 9.5 wins. Tristan and I were both under, believing the Matthew Stafford injury mania. I don't know what it was.
I don't know if it was mania,
Fear
but
mongering.
there was chatter around the Matthew Stafford injury.
It was.
I
It
mean,
was.
we talked about that in
Of
the
course,
piece
it was.
that came out that they gave him. We talked about that before, but they gave him the opportunity to talk to other teams, including the Raiders. Like
No. This
this
is in
wasn't.
terms of his injury. Like we thought he wasn't going to be healthy for this season. That's why I went under. But Ben kept the faith, not only made this an over, but also made it a lock. The Rams
There we
obviously
go.
won 12 games. The Miami Dolphins, a line of 8.5 wins, all under. Tristan made this a lock, and they won seven games. So Tristan, two for two on his locks. Minnesota Vikings, a line of 8.5 wins. I was over. Tristan and Ben were both under on this one because
they
the Vikings
this.
Had such a... They did cover it.
Wow.
Process-wise, I don't feel like I was right here, but they did win 9 games.
They won their last 5 games. I didn't realize that.
I didn't realize that, actually.
They were 4-8.
Was the Seahawks their last loss?
Yes.
New England Patriots, the Super Bowl 60 bound New England Patriots had a line of 8.5 wins. No, you were over on this one.
Okay.
Ben and I were under. The stat community was skeptical, and obviously they won 14 games. New Orleans Saints had a line of 4.5 wins, and two of you non-believers took the under on the Fighting Saints.
We didn't know how early in the season they would get shuck in. That's the thing. That was a Spencer Rattler under, not a Tyler Shuck under.
And they won 6 games. I hit the over on this one. New York Giants, a line of 5.5 wins.
They had a 4-game win streak toward the end of the season, those Saints.
Yeah.
I mean, decided the NFC South. New York Giants, a line of 5.5 wins. We were all believing in Russell Wilson redemption. He played well when he got a chance to play early.
That's
in the
what
season.
I'm saying. This was a 5-win team. Wait, was the line 5.5?
That's still would have covered, yeah.
Okay. Needed 6. This was probably an 8-9 team.
We were all, let's all remain calm here.
They started 2-13.
It was a good 2-13.
We'll always have that game, Cowboys Giants game.
That Cowboys game, but the Broncos game too?
Oh, yeah. That was a good game.
We were all over. They went 4-13. New York Jets, also a line of 5.5 wins.
Oh,
also all over this one. Did we forget who was playing quarterback for the Jets? They went 3-14. Philadelphia Eagles, a line of 11.5 wins. Ben was under. Tristan and I were over. They finished with 11 and went under.
That's also another. They had a terrible season and still managed to get to 11 wins. So
yeah. Pittsburgh Steelers, a line of 8.5 wins. This is the year it ends, right?
That's literally what I said on this podcast, that because I know that I've had previous years being like, you idiots, they always get to this amount of wins. But I was like, but this is, it's Rodgers. It really felt like it was going to fall apart.
Understandably. Instead, they won 10 games in the division. San Francisco 49ers, despite boldly predicting on the 2024 year in review podcast that we were going to take the Niners over.
We still didn't take
the Niners. None of us took the Niners over at 10.5 wins. We were all under the Niners.
That's
we
really
won 12
funny.
Games. But we all were conveniently over on the Seattle Seahawks with a line of 8.5 wins in the preseason. Nailed it. Probably should have made that a lock in hindsight. Tampa Bay, a line of 9.5 wins. Ben went over. Tristan and I were under. Not feeling great about this early in the season when they were coming into Seattle and beating the Seahawks, but the Buccaneers slumped down the stretch to 8 wins and an under. Tennessee Titans, a line of 5.5 wins. Somehow I went based on the stat-based projections and gave them an over. Tristan and Ben correctly under as they finished 3-14. Finally, Washington Commanders, 9.5. We'll finish on a strong note. We were all under, and they won 5 games.
Was that bad? Did I amount to doing that badly?
You did the best. You did 50, you got 15 out of 32, correct?
Oh, boy.
I got 12. Ben got 11. So
wow.
This is far and away our worst year. One of the things we look up is, you know, if you take the VIG on each of these, what if you would have bet on the same amount on each of them, what your return would have been. Tristan lost 13% of his money betting on this. I bet lost 32% and Ben lost 36%. So as always, these are not investment advice. The most troubling thing was, so there's 17 where all three of us agreed on them. We got 6 out of 17 correct on those ones.
Usually we do well in those, but not this time.
It was a very unusual year, but we're going to have to like study hard in the off season, hit the books, try to come back better next year. This is basically our version of a lottery season.
I learned nothing from this.
You learned nothing to change?
Yeah, no, I feel like Process was right on a lot of these.
Okay.
The only one that I'm a little surprised by is the Niners, where I'm like, that just doesn't make sense. But every other pick, I'm like, I still agree with my perspective.
I still agree with my perspective, the Tristan Garcia story.
Even as the season played out and these things actually happened.
All right, Ben, we know you've kept you up past your bedtime. We really appreciate your time and coming in to preview a Super Bowl. What a fun sentence to declare out, to say out loud.
Let me note
Thanks for
one
having me.
thing as we, sorry, Ben, to cut you off. Let me note one thing as we leave the over-unders for the season. We did very badly when we all agreed on things.
Oh no. Oh no. I picked the Patriots. 40% odds.
70%,
40% odds of victory.
70% across the board.
Okay, maybe it's because it was actually like 100%.
Yeah.
I've appreciated doing this, not only because it's always great to talk to you guys, but this still doesn't feel real that the Seahawks are in the Super Bowl, and this has kind of like helped me get there a little bit. And it's not just that they like snuck into the playoffs and football's random and they like lucked their way. Like they have the best point differential in the NFL. They have the best DVOA in the NFL, weighted DVOA, and they are favorite in the Super Bowl. They deserve to be there. And it's crazy to think about given the last 5 years of Seahawks football or even expectations coming this season. So it's just trying to enjoy it and hoping for the best on Sunday. It's wild to me that they are in this position.
I think this, like everything, like Kevin mentioned, you should enjoy it while it lasts. This has been the strangest Super Bowl run that the Seahawks have had. And I was like talking to a friend who was at the game after, and she was like, I almost had a heart attack during the game. And I was like, I kind of felt fine the whole time. I don't, and
I did
it's not
not
even,
feel fine.
I don't know what it, I'm truly basically just like, at this point, I must just not care that much. Because the amount that I have been stressed about the Seahawks team has amounted to like one Rams game, maybe two Rams games. The first two Rams games, I got a little worked up when I called Luka cringe for talking about college basketball. By the way, great college basketball season, I think. Right
Really
after he
is.
started talking to me about college basketball, and I was like, I do not give a fuck what Kentucky did today. So that is the only time that I have been worked up this entire season about Seahawks football, and I just like, I feel.
Woolen got the taunting penalty, and you're like, better chance for the offense to keep moving the ball.
I was just like, what the fuck, Reek? But like, I will tell you deep down, and again, this is like full sickos committee level stuff. I was kind of cheering for the Rams to get the ball back.
Wow.
Again,
You didn't feel in a safe enough space to mention that on the emergency pod.
I think I might be in it for a different reason than everybody else. Like that is the only thing that it's like Stranger Things. Like I'm having like the revelation near the last episode. Like I'm like, I think I might feel things differently than other people. Sometimes it's just more about having the experience. Like the Richard Sherman, like now we could sort of like nostalgize the Devin Witherspoon play, right? Or the DeMarcus Lawrence play. But there's still a whole drive that happened after that. Football's boring when it ends like that. I
Okay.
again, I just, I truly don't know if I care that much about blowout victories. So, and the Seahawks team, look at that point differential. It's the best in the league.
That's why Tristan always introduces himself as being from the home of the 2014 NFC Championship game winners, the Seattle Seahawks. All right, Ben. Well, thanks again. Look forward to chatting again after the Super Bowl.
Box.
Oh, well, thanks again to Ben for joining us. And now let's get to the remainder of this week's pod, starting with our lone toast this week. Two legendary Mariners broadcaster, Rick Riz, who announced that he will retire after the upcoming 2026 season, his 41st behind the mic in Seattle. I mean, we'll have, probably time throughout this season to remember Rick Riz and everything he's meant to Mariners fandom. But, what awesome for him to be able to sort of be able to go out on his terms and hopefully to be able to go out with a World Series.
Seahawks make one Super Bowl and we become so confident.
I need more about the getting within 5 outs of
I
the
know, I know, I know.
World Series. I like that idea, though, that now we're like the Kraken are gonna win the Stanley Cup.
We're like bandwagon fans, like people who just cheer for the only the good teams. We just assume good stuff, like Boston fans.
I mean,
Rick Riz rules, though. it's funny, we talked about this one time where I was like, I was saying something about Rick Riz being on TV, and you were like, I think radio is like the premier job, because that's what it is for Rick Riz, and especially like old school baseball guy, you know? Right. Rick Riz, as much as Dave Niehaus now for us, I mean, I'm not going to say that I've spent all of these years post Dave Niehaus listening to the Mariners, but in the last, I don't know, I've paid a lot more attention to the Mariners than you have in the last 15 years or something like that.
Correct.
And the amount of time that you spend listening to baseball on the radio versus any other sport,
oh yeah,
is just what baseball is about. Like, the radio is essential to the baseball experience.
100%. And you know, I now associate like Rick Riz with mowing our mom's lawn and listening to the Mariners games, which I did a shocking number of times because it just sort of happened to line up in the schedule that way last season. And it is kind of interesting because, you know, when we started following the Mariners, Dave Niehaus already seemed like, you know, a grandparent. Rick Riz was,
I mean,
more
I'm sure,
like,
he was, right?
You know, what was that age? Rick Riz was like our parents' generation. And it wasn't really until I started listening to him again lately that I started to realize, oh yeah, Rick Riz has been doing this a long time. And because he's like telling stories about his minor league days in the late 70s and early 80s. And it's like, wow, that was a very long time ago. But
there's really just like a special skill. And I think Aaron Goldsmith is awesome. There's a little bit of like when it gets to be Aaron Goldsmith and Ryan Ruhlen-Smith where I'm like, it feels like we're a little bit too close to inventing the bus sometimes when it's those two dudes together. And Rick Riz is baseball through and through.
I would never say that.
But you understand what I'm saying? It gives me a little bit of like the dudes who worked it. When I worked in sports, there is a tier of dude where I'm like, these are my dudes. That's fine. You know, like the bro-y spot side of the sports business side. And for me, as somebody who's like culturally was a little bit different, Rick Riz is like that dude is, that man cares about baseball.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I don't agree with this take, first off, but I do agree with the Rick Riz part of it. And, you know, just like the storytelling element on radio, where it's not necessarily about watching the game, it's not necessarily about the stats, it's just about like passing the time.
Yeah.
And Rick Riz is awesome at doing that. It's an old school baseball trait.
The amount of time that, and there are times this year where you're like, oh, all right, Rick Riz, like some of the stories. But like, honestly, that's what you love about these broadcasters is the stories, even when they're dipping back to like way before we were ever, you know, like we've been paying attention to baseball for a long time. And when they dip into stories that are like 70s baseball and stuff like that, that is like part of the experience of the sport, is that this like history of it. And that's what Rick Riz is really great at. And it's funny, people talk about like, you listen to podcasts, right? Because it feels like hanging out with your friends.
Yep.
And baseball is probably the most essential experience of that.
They kind of invented the podcast.
Sports radio is another one of those. But like,
no, but sports radio is a very different feel. What I'm saying is the hanging out element.
Exactly. Yes.
And like,
sports radio is a lot of like, there's segments. Sports radio still invented the podcast, though. Like,
there's an urgency to sports radio that does not exist to a baseball radio broadcast.
But yes, the way that stories can kind of just meander.
Yep.
On the radio, like, and you could sort of just like tell it over a long period of time, drop in and talk about like the play that's happening, and then come back to it.
And a deep drive to left by Castellanos.
Well, I don't think we need to do that one, but
no, Rick Riz is not doing that one,
but it is like, I think he is after Dave Niehaus, which, you know, Dave Niehaus has obviously been like entered the echelon of like greatest announcer, obviously, in I think Seattle history. It's him and Kevin Colabro, I think, at this point, right? And even Kevin Colabro spent so many years not announcing games in Seattle that Dave Niehaus kind of like that tiers, it's him alone. And I think right after that is Rick Riz, probably.
Yeah, certainly in terms of the longevity piece of it. And, you know, I think Bob Rondo certainly needs to be mentioned high in that list. Pete Gross in the Seahawks days, you know, early on. And Steve Rabel for his longevity. Like, the radio piece of it for Seahawks is not the same as it is for baseball. But
Yeah. But no, Rabe still is like he's the voice of the Seahawks, obviously. It's just not a thing that you do in the same way that like usually for most Seahawks games, you're kind of locked in on the TV.
for sure. All right.
Anyway, it'll be sad to see Rick Riscoe. It does feel like there are a lot of things changing right now.
For sure. Change is inevitable. All right, let's get into the roundup. Where the Seattle Kraken have now won 3 of 4 after beating the New Jersey Devils 4-2 on Sunday and the Washington Capitals 5-1 on Tuesday night, despite having a pair of goals called back. One of those took an apparent hat trick away from Jared McCann after fans threw their caps on the ice when he scored. In a savvy move, the Kraken offered to replace them with new ones for the first 1,000 fans who said that they threw them on the ice. The win moved Kraken back into a
What do
three-team
they do
tie.
normally when they throw them on the ice? They just.
I think there is some element of this, but perhaps not as widespread or as publicized.
And for this one, because they were like, this should have been a hat trick. We'll replace them with a Kraken hat or something.
Yeah, and people kind of got they bought the hat trick and didn't get it there. The win moved the Kraken back into a three-team tie for 7th in the West. They'll wrap up their homestand Thursday versus the Toronto Maple Leafs in their final home game prior to the Olympic break. They're out on the road for the final 3 games before the break starting Saturday in
And we're going to
Vegas.
be previewing the Olympics extensively, right?
Oh, I've been scouting the
I
rosters.
do wonder if Heated Rival are you and or Grace in on Heated Rivalry?
Grace has begun watching it.
It's
I've
only
not
six
yet watched
episodes,
it.
begun watching. But I do wonder if the interest in hockey and especially like international hockey is going to increase because of this.
It's a great way to drive interest, certainly.
There's so many times when you might not even realize that you're in what is about to be like a boom time of something, in a way that like hockey was dead, right? At various different times throughout time periods. But like how much something can flip overnight in culture. And we feel like we understand what a trend is, but we honestly have no idea.
I mean, Netflix has done it before. Look at F1.
Well, even F1, it's like my number one thing that I say about things is by the time anybody says it's a thing, that means it's over. But like in the same way that New York is so over, everybody's in LA now. But like when the influencers moved to New York, you knew that New York was over. But I do feel F1 became much bigger, right? That was almost more like planned in a way. Like Netflix made like a specific investment in that show. This is a TV show that came out of nowhere. And I
I'd
do
agree with
think,
that.
at the very least, will increase some interest in hockey, at least a small amount.
Well,
And
we're
for me,
still.
I was already a huge Kraken fan, so I knew all about that Jared McCann hat trick you were talking about. It should have been a hat trick. We were all angry about it.
I actually watched the end of that one because the NBA games were over for the night, so it was a nice chance to watch. The Kraken post game was heated, not necessarily about the call that called back the McCann hat trick, but the timing of it and some of the way that the rules were applied. All right, Seattle Sounders lost their preseason opener to Norwegian club Brøndby IF 2-0 on Friday. Some exciting Sounders news. They signed Nuhu to a 3-year contract extension through 2028-29. The longtime Sounders defender was entering the final year of his contract, which will mark a decade in Seattle this season. Still just 28, so very much in his prime years. UW basketball, the women are on fire. They are hot. The East Coast is freezing cold, which forced their game, which was scheduled Sunday at Rutgers, to be postponed to Monday. Couldn't stop the Huskies from a dominant 76-48 win over a struggling Golden Knights team, behind 17 points on 8 of 9 shooting and 7 boards from Bryn McGoy off the bench. Yulia Grabovskaya grabbed 17 rebounds, 10 offensive. Avery Howell had 16 points in 7 rebounds. The schedule toughened on Wednesday night as the Huskies were at number 16 Maryland and extended their winning streak to 5, working double OT. They trailed the Terps 22-11 after one quarter, but rallied to tie the game after 3. El-Ladin had a three-pointer with 13 seconds left in regulation that tied the score, sending it to overtime. Xavier Sellers gave the Huskies the edge with 4 seconds left in the first extra session before Howell was called for a loose ball foul inside the final second, and the Terps' Sailor Poffenbarger hit split two free throws, forcing double OT. Huskies led throughout that session. Sellers played 47 minutes, scoring a career-high 38 points on 15 of 32 shooting to lead the Husky attack. Howell had 17 points and 11 boards. Huskies now up to 17-4 on the season, 7-3 in Big Ten play, albeit with some of their most difficult matchups still remaining. Sunday, they are back home to take on Illinois, which started 13-1, albeit with just one over a top 60 team on Bart Torvik. Then that coming at home against the same Maryland team. But since then, have dropped 3 of 5. Illinois, very, very solid offensively, number 24 in adjusted offensive efficiency on Bart Torvik, not as effective on defense, only average in terms of two-point defense. So a chance for the Huskies to make some hay in the paint and hopefully extend this winning streak to 6 at home. You know, men's basketball. The schedule finally broke on Sunday as they welcomed the injury-plagued Oregon Ducks to Heck Ed. They led Huskies led this one 14-2 early by as many as 17 in the first half, en route to a 72-57 win. Five players scored double figures, three of them reserves, including 12 from Jacob Bogdanovic, who went 4 of 5 from three-point range. As the Huskies shot nearly 50% beyond the arc as a team and overcame Hannes Steinbeck shooting just 3 of 16 from the field, albeit with 13 boards, I should say. Back on the road this weekend, and their last of the extremely difficult Big Ten games to start the conference season comes at Illinois on Thursday. The Illini up to number 4 in KenPom after winning at Purdue on Saturday behind 46 points from freshman guard Keaton Wagler, who was not really a particularly heralded recruit, but now is a likely NBA lottery pick, probably a top 10 pick. So you got a battle of two top freshmen here between Wagler and Steinbach. That was the Illini's ninth consecutive win, improving to 8-1 in Big Ten play. They're number 1 on KenPom in adjusted offensive efficiency. Brothers Tomislav and Zvonimir Ivicic dominate the offensive glass along with power forward David Mirkovic, while Andrei Stoyakovic is a dangerous driver. Despite a pretty solid perimeter defender in Kylan Boswell starting alongside, we remember from his days at Arizona, starting alongside Wagler in the backcourt, they never force any turnovers, but also allow the lowest free throw rate in college hoops. So be prepared to be frustrated about the lack of whistles in this one.
Stoyakovic was also huge in that upset last week, right? He had a monster game.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a really nice season for them.
That's Paige's kid, right?
It is, yes.
Okay.
Started out, I think, at Stanford and then maybe went to Cal before going to Illinois. So it's been a bit of a circuitous route for Stojakovic, but he's really developed into quite a nice player, a very different one than his dad, because he is not known at all for his outside shooting. So
what game was that he went off in? I thought it wasn't the Purdue game. It was... maybe it was
Maryland, 30 points, 9 of 18.
And they won that game easily, yeah.
I mean, Maryland is not very good, but...
kind of like a hit-and-miss shooter. Well, those kids aren't going to win this game.
They probably are not, no.
But I will say, the victory over Oregon, like having a comfortable victory, what Jacob Bogdanovic has done since he's been back, Wesley Yates being healthy, I will tell you, as I look at the schedule, there's a glimmer of hope.
KenPom still has very consistently had them finishing right around 500 in conference play. Now that's with them is the favorite in their final 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 conference.
You have to
games.
Win the games. And right. that's the hard part is they basically the hole that they've dug themselves is, and I look back at each of the individual games and I'm kind of like, in conference play, obviously Seattle U is the brutal one, but like in conference play, I look at them and I'm like, I can't complain about any of these losses necessarily.
No, certainly not. I mean, Michigan State's up to number 7 in KenPom. Michigan has dropped out of the number 1 spot.
No, I've seen that. They're still freaking good. I think we actually knew when we watched Michigan those two games in a row that they played, and even watching them, it was a little bit like, this team is not quite as good as they seemed early on.
Right.
And Big Ten play is just, it is a gauntlet. to get through Big Ten play, or at
It
least
is
what the Huskies have
particularly,
done.
yeah, it is particularly the way that the schedule has fallen, where, there's these four teams outside the top 97 in KenPom, Oregon's 98, and then three in the hundreds, and the Huskies did not face any of them in their first eight conference games out of 20. So, they got Oregon, they play them twice. Five of their final 12 will be against the teams in that category, and you've also got Minnesota at 82, Northwestern at 62 is much more winnable games than what they have been facing.
Oh, and yeah, I guess you mentioned Illinois also playing at Northwestern this week.
Yes, that is the game on Saturday to complete this road trip. I was trying to look up the Huskies' overall strength of schedule, number 18 in the country at this point, and that's with a relatively easy non-conference schedule. By the way, one of their non-conference losses have not generally aged well. Seattle U is 3-7 in the West Coast
Oh,
Conference. Colorado
how did
is,
they lose that game?
I don't know. Colorado has lost five in a row in, granted, a very difficult Big 12 conference. And Baylor, who we thought was probably going to be pretty good, they are 1-7 in Big 12 play. So not ideal. Any of
It's
that.
taken a second for this UW team to figure each other out and to get a bunch of players back. But okay, what I'll say about Illinois is it is an opportunity. And that's the only way to look at it is if they get an upset, you have a signature win. And
Oh,
that's the
it's
most important thing. It's
all
what this team
upside.
needs. If you lose, whatever, who cares? Then they pretty much need to rattle off almost every single game in a row.
I mean, not necessarily every single game in a row, but they need to get a game in addition to the games that
How
I guess
many
they don't.
losses can they withstand? Well, Iowa is the only one
I
where
think
I'm
it's.
kind of like, Iowa is an opportunity because I was at home. Like, I don't know if KenPom favors the Huskies in that game,
Doesn't favor
but
him, but 43%.
that's kind of the game they need to win. Because
I mean.
even if the committee is looking at it and you ended up being at 500 or even just above 500 in the Big Ten, you probably make the tournament, but you're on the fringe, right? And that's only just beating all of the bad teams. That's no good wins on the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, you probably have to for sure get into the top 10 in the Big Ten. And right now, that would mean finishing 500 or better. Indiana projected at 500 in 10th place.
But I don't feel like it's impossible, is
No, it's
what I'll
definitely not
say. It's
impossible.
definitely they have to take it game by game. But when you look at the schedule, like Illinois, they're going to lose, but then they pretty much have to win at Northwestern. That pair right there is probably the most important games on the schedule at this point after that at Northwestern hosting Iowa. And if they can win both of those, all of a sudden they're in a pretty good position.
I mean, UCLA is also a plausible win.
Maybe it's those three in a row. Like, I mean, if they can win all three, then they're probably in a very good position for the.
Yeah, they'd be in a really good position then.
Those are all winnable games. I mean, considering the standard of what we're talking about, like, none of those three teams are top 10 teams in the country. And it's not like they've been playing good teams. This isn't Pac-12 shit. You know what I mean? This
No.
isn't like, ah, it's a tough road trip at Colorado. These are the best teams in the country
I mean,
that they've been
all.
playing.
Of the, so if you don't count the UCLA and USC games, which are sort of disconnected from the bulk of conference play, their first six games in real conference play featured four teams who would be favored to make the Sweet 16 at the end of the season. And then you've got this Illinois who would be the fifth. And again, they don't face anyone that good the rest of the season.
Yeah, so I kind of look at it and I'm like, if the team they beat Oregon and Hontas did not have a particularly good game, we'll see if there's maybe an element of because I don't actually think Hontas has played particularly well lately at all. But there could be he's a freshman, you know, he might not physically be ready for the entire slate of and going through this Big Ten slate as somebody who's slightly undersized versus some of the bigs that he's playing against. But
I don't
Jacob
know.
Ignacevich.
I'm not that worried about it.
I'm not saying I'm worried about it necessarily, but like, I don't know. When was the last time he played? I guess at Nebraska, he wasn't bad, right?
21 points on 7 of 12 from the
Okay,
field, 12 boards. Yeah, I wouldn't say that's bad.
he played well against Nebraska, but the Michigan games and the Oregon game were not good. So the three of his last four haven't been very good.
I mean, even the Michigan State game, 17 points, 6 of 14 from the field, 9 rebounds. This is a pretty high bar you're setting for a
Six of,
freshman.
but sure, but six. This is talking about a player who would. Hypothetically, wanting to lead the team as a freshman to the NCAA tournament. being as a big at 6 of 14, you know yourself that's not a good field goal percentage.
No, but it's not like I'm looking at it and saying that's a bad game.
But right now, Ignacevich is back. Wesley Yates is back. The team's playing pretty well together overall.
I mean, Michigan State is now number one in the country in adjusted defensive efficiency, excluding nobody. They are only the 13th lowest in effective field goal percentage. So, you know,
it's
not
kind
that
of ridiculous.
Hard.
Wesley Yates making threes is exciting. And
let's hope he can stay healthy. Had, you know, a bit of a scare with his wrist in the Oregon game where he went back to the locker room briefly, then maybe came down on someone's ankle. It's like, oh man, Wesley Yates, like, you know, I don't know what we need to do, but to break this, but you know, let's figure out something because I want to see you be able to stay healthy.
And Zoom's been playing really well. This is the kind of, like, I think we all assume Hannes is probably going to the NBA after this year. Kepnong must be done with eligibility, right?
I don't think he can get any more eligibility now.
But I do think finishing the season strong is going to be important as a springboard for Danny Sprinkle in the years to come.
I would agree.
Both in keeping these players, but then also in enticing other players. Money is obviously a huge factor. But if you're looking at a program that's one of the worst in the country or one of the worst in the Big Ten, it's a little bit of a harder sell if you're talking apples to apples on money. Whereas if you're looking at a team that's 500 in the Big Ten with maybe some players returning, all of a sudden they can go out in the portal and do some things.
Agreed.
So.
All right. So Northwestern.
Game by game, obviously.
Yeah. 1-8 in Big Ten play. On this podcast, it'd be 2 games by 2 games because of the way we do the previews. Northwestern 1-8 in Big Ten play, albeit with several close losses. They got their first win last week at USC. They're led by senior forward Nick Martinelli, an NBA prospect who's shooting 48% from three. The Wildcats, with their sort of deliberate offense, boast the nation's lowest turnover rate. So any miscues the Huskies can force, a positive thing. All right, let's wrap up with UW football. The 2026 Big Ten schedule is out. The Huskies will open conference play by hosting Minnesota, then visiting USC. They play Nebraska and Lincoln on Halloween. Penn State visits November 7th and defending champion Indiana in the home finale on November 21st, sandwiched around a trip to Michigan State. And the Huskies will finish the season with their two playoff opponents, the Hoosiers and then Oregon in Eugene.
Man, it's so funny. Like, you have in your head what the schedule is going to be a little bit. Like, I don't know why, but I sort of just had slotted people in mentally in different places.
Indiana seemed like a really October matchup to me.
I was like, for some reason, it has to be that last week of September, first week of, and I think it's because that's when we played Michigan and Ohio State.
Right.
The week before the Oregon game was definitely not what I was anticipating.
Not on your bingo card.
I mean, not that like there's any reason any game should have been different than any other game. The funny thing is, like, in the Pac-12, you could be like, oh, well, you might have an advantage weather-wise over some of these teams. And it's like, guess what? All of these teams play in worse weather than us, basically. So there's no, like, coming to Seattle is a break from the weather for most, you know, Penn State and for Indiana in November.
I suppose so, yes. But them coming here in November than the Huskies going there in November. Their only, you know, November game outside of the West Coast will be Michigan State on November 14th. So we'll see what it looks like then.
I mean, we knew what the schedule was. I don't think the order of the games really matters all that much, I guess is what I'll say. But it's nice seeing them laid out. I guess it had been known that the Apple Cup was going to be on Labor Day weekend, but it is definitely, it came as a surprise still. It wasn't known to me.
I didn't know it until LVAK mentioned it in the Discord in the context of the fact that should there be a Thursday night football game in Seattle in week one, that would be part of sort of a, 5-day celebration of football.
I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing about what I'm trying to decide whether I like it on Labor Day, because I do kind of like having the matchup on like a type of day, you know, rather than just like September 20th or whatever. This year would be September 19th. That's just sort of a random day where it's like, if it's every Labor Day weekend, it is the Apple Cup. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, sort of set it as a fixture. I don't think that either team probably wants to open the season that way, ideally, but You're right. Having a fixed date for it would be positive. I
It
mean, the question
makes it,
is.
if you're booking in the schedule with the Apple Cup and Oregon, all of a sudden it's kind of like you've got these pillars now in a schedule, and even just for fan interest. But at the same time, it's kind of like, missing that Labor Day game or having to pay very little attention. It's like if I have an artist playing Bumbershoot, I'm like, well, fuck, now I like need them to be on the day after.
I know that we're all thinking about your schedule when we
Well,
think about
if
it.
it was Eastern, there are people who have plans over Labor Day weekend
There are many people,
that are
yes.
not college football. And if it's UC Davis or if it's Eastern or something like that, I couldn't even tell you who we played this last year. Kent State.
Who did we play last year? I think Kent State was week two. No, I guess the FCS opponent
Colorado
was week
State.
two.
I was going to say, I was there. Could I tell you anything about that Colorado State game?
I see. I wasn't there, so I there was like a yeah.
Wait,
There
you
was
hear me play Kent State? It's been a while.
a
2022. To me, it was
okay.
recent.
So Oregon and Oregon State are not playing in 2026, and the athletic directors at both schools told the Oregonian that their focus is on attempting to resume the rivalry in 2027. So, look, playing Washington State at all, I think, is a win right now at this point, from the standpoint of keeping that rivalry going.
I think that was definitely important to them. I'm a little bit like, why? I guess I don't understand why they can't play each other. Is that Portland State game just so important? Were they scared of Boise State?
It's not as apparently as much on Oregon's end as Oregon State having two other Power Four opponents in non-conference. So,
So Oregon was down to play them.
I mean, like people were not, there wasn't like a disagreement between the two sides, but I think Oregon could have done it more easily than Oregon State, basically.
Okay, so here's what I'll tell you. I of course looked at the Husky schedule, and do you know what I did next?
What's that?
I looked at the Oregon schedule.
How's that looking?
I mean, again, it was known who they were playing, but I do think there's an interesting wrinkle here, which is in back-to-back weeks, USC hosts Oregon and then UW.
That's interesting.
And so it'll give some perspective, I guess, on all three of these teams. And I think there's three teams that are kind of in that tier of could one of the like Oregon's probably, if we're being honest with ourselves, in a higher tier than either USC or UW. But the goal for both USC and UW with returning quarterbacks, obviously Oregon does too, but the goal is for all three of these teams to be in the playoff conversation. And after those 2 weeks, we're going to have quite a bit of clarity on kind of where all these teams stand to a certain extent. So that's a fascinating one. I mean, like, Oregon also, it's not easy. Boise State's not as good as they have been in the past. This isn't Aston Jeanne's Boise State necessarily. At Oklahoma State, people are excited about Oklahoma State football. This was a game that last year I think they won by 150 points. Do you know what the score was their game against Oklahoma State last year?
I don't.
69 to 3.
Hoorah,
But all of a sudden, Oklahoma State is like one of the most exciting young coaches and one of the most important quarterbacks in the transfer portal. So that's also, and they're going at Oklahoma State. Like, that's a losable game. That USC one is a losable game. The schedule's pretty similar, but they go at Ohio State November. They're leading up to UW is at Ohio State, hosting Michigan, at Michigan State, then UW. Like,
huh.
that is, it's a very difficult November. And there's a way that UW kind of, we're hosting our harder games in that part of the season. Is what I'll say.
Oh,
Like,
they're hosting their harder game at that part of the season.
hello. No, I'm talking about
I
before then. But
know.
like in Indiana and Penn State in November, the home games for UW are Penn State and Indiana, which first off, that's just gonna be fun.
Agreed.
November football is generally pretty fun, I'd say. I wouldn't mind if the games were in October, but
I don't know. I feel like October football is more likely to be like a sunny Saturday, and November is more likely to be it just pours
weather.
all day.
I think I'm okay with that
It's
for those
dark at 3
games.
p.m.
The other thing is, like, again, we knew that we were hosting Iowa, but Iowa's always a hard game, and especially a hard game at Iowa. I look at the road schedule and I'm kind of like USC, I called it on the the season or on the Paul Nikastor interview. I just don't feel great about that one. October 3rd at USC, at Purdue, at Nebraska, at Michigan State. Bring it to me. Like, they strike no fear in my heart, those three games.
Okay.
So, Halloween against Nebraska.
What's the expression again? Get your hopes up.
Get your hopes up.
Yeah, the Halloween game should be a lot of fun.
I mean, it's also like we haven't played Nebraska since we've gotten to the Big Ten, right?
Oh no, not since the Big Ten. No, I don't know how many teams left have the Huskies not faced as Big Ten opponents.
I think that's it.
No, there's got to be more than that.
We played Northwestern this year. We technically haven't played Michigan State as a Big Ten opponent.
There you go.
And are obviously playing them.
Purdue came here last year.
Yes.
Minnesota.
Oh yeah, no, we haven't played Minnesota either yet.
Yeah, so there's still a few left that are new. And then 2027 will be the last year where
we hadn't played USC as a Big Ten team either.
No, they played USC. They hosted USC the first year. Jaden Mayava came in relief. Don't you remember?
Not really. I remember we won the game, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He like took the starting job
from
in
Miller
that game. Yeah. And the rest is history.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was number one in QBR.
Yeah, I mean, he's good.
But Nebraska, I'm just like, I'm sure they'll find a quarterback, but I can't remember who they signed in the transfer portal.
Definitely not something I care about enough to know. Would you like to talk about UW's transfer commitments?
Anthony Calandria. He is pretty good.
Because UW signed a quarterback.
Hello.
Yeah, transfer. It's Stanford's Elijah Brown, who played two seasons on the farm, redshirting in 2024 with three games of action before starting the final three games of 2025. Threw for 284 yards in his first start at North Carolina, taking 9 sacks, but just 327.
He took 9 sacks.
On 57 attempts combined against Cal and Notre Dame.
Drake May-like stats.
I was actually thinking of Devon Williams' first start at Oregon. Yeah. Or I guess, yeah, that was his first start. Finished with a 41 QBR that would have ranked last in the Big Ten. So going to take some development in the Jed Fish system if he's going to be an heir apparent to Damon Williams in 2027 or beyond. But you
not
know,
much of a runner, Elijah Brown. I mean, that's kind of why QBR doesn't like him. And, you know, he was negative rushing yards.
I think it's also the 6.5 yards per attempt is not super QBR friendly.
I don't think we need to view this as Damon Williams. Like, I don't think we need to view this as meaning anything about Damon Williams. And I think people are viewing it as meaning anything about Damon Williams.
No, I don't think so.
I think the Huskies felt like they wanted a slightly more experienced backup quarterback. I think I believe he recruited Elijah Brown, right? Initially.
Like when he was coming.
Before he committed to Stanford. I'm not 100% sure on that, but. I will say that I think this means more about is Keeney McMillan and Dash Byerly.
I would agree.
So, and I also, there was in the moments in the couple of days that we felt like Damon was leaving, there was not a lot of steam towards it's going to be one of these two dudes, which is a little surprising to me that neither of them is transferred at this point. And is there's still another transfer portal or is that it?
There's no longer a spring window. So yes, they are, you know, barring something unforeseen, locked into UW's roster for 2026.
I kind of felt like Keeney McMillan was going to be a ball player. We'll see, but he also might, you know, like if you think that you know anything about what a college football roster is going to look like a year from now, you're wrong.
I agree.
I guess is what I'll say. Or if you think you could even read the tea leaves, even if Jed Fish, like, I don't think Jed Fish knows what the roster, I don't, Jed Fish might not know what team he's coaching.
Exactly. I was going to make that particular point.
But like, I would not take this to mean anything about Damon Williams. If Damon is good enough, next season and the team is good enough, UW will find a way to pay him the most money. That is, there weren't. Let me see. I mean,
I don't know. They'll find a way to pay him the most money.
Hold on.
They did. Jed Fish and Jimmy Doherty did recruit him well at Arizona before coming to UW. So
I mean, it's there were some coaches who changed teams, and then there were some quarterbacks who are graduating. But I'm pretty sure there were no quarterbacks who played in the college football playoff who then transferred after, aside from having the coaches leaving.
Makes sense.
You're kind of not like in the
college football playoff.
No, I'm saying if they play well enough, value for Damon Williams is. I mean, he could also go
to the NFL.
Not an NFL player, but the.
Well, the president of the Damon Williams fan club is ruling out. I did all the hater work
like 2 weeks ago. That's Don't true. Forget, I did all my hater research. It's there. I didn't throw away the hater research. I mean, a lot of these quarterbacks are going to the NFL who played in the college football playoff, but like there is a reality that to be as valuable, I mean, who knows what the numbers we're going to be talking about next year. It could be up to $10 million for quarterbacks, but like
I would say to assume we know what the rules are going to be in a year is also sure. a mistake.
If UW reaches those heights with demand, it'll be because Damon is playing well. And it also will open up budgets for Damon. So seeing like, let's say that they make the playoff and they lose in the first or second round, something like that. I would expect Damon Williams to be back the next year after that. If they don't make the playoff and he's good, but not amazing next year, I would say that Elijah Brown probably would not be the quarterback of UW the following year, or Keenan McMillan or Dash Byerly. Because there's a reality that it might not be Damon Williams, and it could be any of the sea of other players, quarterbacks who exist across the country. More than when I was,
I don't like, know about any, but yes, there's 100 people who could be.
There have not been that many teams. I've actually been kind of surprised by it. Who there's a little bit of a grass is greener with quarterbacks right now, and the players who are being developed don't seem to get the starting jobs at programs of this size. In the way that for Nebraska, I was obviously like, they put everything into Rayola, but I was like, who did they sign in the portal? Because that's just what you do. So, other transfer news?
Yeah, the other commitment to UW. So the period to submit a notification of transfer has passed. There is no deadline to commit to a new school. If you've submitted that notification, so that can happen at any point. The other commitment to UW is Ohio State wide receiver Bodpin Miller, a 4-star recruit from the state of Ohio who played quarterback, DB, and punter in high school before redshirting last year while making that position change. Great size at 6'3". That's something the Huskies have evidently been looking for. 4 years of eligibility remaining, so we will see on this one. Sure. One bit of Seahawks news that we did not cover with Ben, Clint Kubiak. It's been reported by my ESPN colleagues, Peter Schrager and Jeremy Fowler, scheduled to meet with Las Vegas and Arizona this weekend during the bye weekend of the Super Bowl. And Jeremy Fowler reported that those interviews are expected to happen Saturday in Seattle. He also said the belief from some in the league is Kubiak is the lead candidate in both.
He gone.
So. A preemptive congrats to Clint Kubiak, unless he's very bad at interviewing. So
we kind of knew this when Clint came here, that if things went well, he was on a track. He's got the last name for NFL coaching job, and if there's one thing that NFL franchises love, it's a last name. And he's been a good
second thing that NFL teams love. It's scoring 42 points in the playoffs.
Sure.
Granted, it was only 35 on offense.
I will be very fascinated at how the Seahawks approach this with the new offensive coordinator. The timing has not been great for them because so many other teams have been able to go find kind of the prime. I mean, my Kafka bold prediction, right? Kafka's off the market. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Where did he go? I was not following that closely. I mean, Mike McDaniel obviously is the disappointing one to me.
Yeah, he went to the Lions, Mike Kafka. which is a great job. Like, I don't begrudge Mike Kafka for taking the offensive coordinator job with the Lions, but like,
what offensive coordinator job would you begrudge Mike Kafka taking?
The Raiders. Like, if Mike Kafka was like, yeah, the Cardinals, like, I'm good not being the coach, OC for the Cardinals, I like what y'all are building here, I would begrudge Mike Kafka for that. In fact, there's many jobs that I would begrudge Mike Kafka for taking.
Mike Kafka has to live his own life. You don't know what he's prioritizing. So, you know, there could be many myriad reasons. So,
he went through quite a metamorphosis, though. I wasn't sure whether
to make that pun. I opted against it, and you surprisingly
never. This is the only reason we wanted him as offensive coordinator.
You are the dad on this podcast, so you should make that joke appropriately. I mean, we can discuss that if and when it happens, but yeah, there's not an obvious succession plan for Clint Kubiak as OC should he get this job. All right. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Were you looking up other Kafka publications? Were you looking for additional puns? Maybe you should just go with him. I don't know if we need to after the pod.
I really wanted to talk about Luca as the existentialist. I just gonna say this. So there's a concert by a rap artist named Jid at the Paramount yesterday.
Okay.
And I asked for guest list too late and I didn't hear back soon enough.
Wow.
About this concert. I'll be honest, I wasn't that excited about going to the show. And Luca all of a sudden became an existentialist because of it, where he was like, what is the point of doing anything at all in the world? We're just gonna die someday.
Why? Oh boy, that's a tough question to answer, really, when you think about it.
It reminded me of when he was in preschool and
he was worried about how old he was getting.
No, I mean, there was part of that too, but he was like, so another kid at preschool had a play date and he turned into Morrissey. That moment he laid on the couch in anguish, and that's when we had the song I never had a play date ever. That was the song that we kept singing to him, because we're not good parents to accept your anguish about not having a play date.
To enable the anguish.
I was like, he turned into fucking Sartre after not going to the Jid show. He's going to look back at this moment as everything changed before and after missing the Jid show. He is, however, organizing a walkout tomorrow at Northwood Middle School. So,
oh, kudos for him.
Yeah. There was some kid who was like,
On Friday, right?
On Friday. Sorry. There was a kid in the chat who was like, we're going to do a sit-in on Friday. And I was like, what does that mean? A sit-in? And I was like, you're going to sit in your class for 50 minutes and then go to your next class and sit in again and then learn. We're going to sit in our class and we're going to learn for 50 minutes. And then we're going to go to the next class and we're going to sit in again. But Luca's organizing a walkout. So I was like,
is the golf course prepared?
Yeah. But I did appreciate that he's on this group text.
The kids are all right.
Organizing that walkout. No, it's cool. I mean, everything else is bad, but like that part's cool.
I everything is bad, but again, there's a resilience and a collective spirit that has been awakened in this moment that, you know, I think can be a positive. So.
On that note, no, you just did that.
Yeah. No, I mean, you were talking over it, so.
Okay.
On that note.
Thanks for listening. Next week is number 500?
Next week is number 500. I guess we forgot to give the call. So if you made it this long, you definitely have some favorite memories from the PeltonCast Discord, PeltonCast@gmail.com, PeltonCast on Blue Sky, wherever you want to hit us up and let us know your favorite segments to put in there.
I was trying to think of two of my favorite segments to tell you. I mean, I really was thinking back on it and I was like, I've just hated every experience here. But there's two from PeltonCast Dark Ages, are those eligible?
Nah, I mean, they're not counted within the 500.
They're not counted with it. So we can't dip into those because those are two of my favorite memories.
Is it the World Cup?
What World Cup?
The Women's World Cup.
Oh, the post-game pod?
Yeah.
That we did in Chris's basement?
Yeah.
I mean, that was pretty fun. Did I tell you I saw Chris outside of Katie's house?
You did not tell me that.
I was like, let's watch the Super Bowl together. This was before the NFC Championship game. And he said, I think you're a little too confident. Or I'm basically like, it makes me nervous how confident you are.
I take his side.
Guess who was right? Flash forward to this week. All of a sudden, we're going to be watching the Super Bowl.
Well, he was going to say, hopefully not his at his house. It's a different house, so it's not.
I don't know. It's still a little bit like we're not going to do well for that Super Bowl.
But keep it in Fairwood. We're 1-0 in all time in Fairwood.
We are. Katie's house is undefeated in Super Bowls. So, but I lost my train of thought. Oh, that was a fun one, though. I'm telling you, the list of players, this was past dark ages. When you were talking about the list of players and you were like listing off things, you were like, good range, has a 3-point shot, good passer, I love him. And then, do you remember that? As if it was just like an attribute that he had, or you were like trying to sneakily include that you were in love with a basketball player.
I do remember that. I have no idea who the player was.
I wish we could find that. And then there was a bumper shoot where we had seen Third Eye Blind. But this was before I was all in on Third Eye Blind. And now I fucking love 3EB. But for whatever reason, 2015 or something earlier? Must have been earlier, right? It was the year that Macklemore headlined Bumper Shoot. It was pretty early. And then I broke out on it. I remember having the like a paper plate with top five like 90s alternative songs on it. I remember that being like a phenomenal podcast. That Bumper Shoot. Yeah. I remember that being really fun. Those are my two favorite moments.
So I have to listen through the entire Bumper Shoot podcast to find which part
it's like right after.
Okay.
It's like right at the beginning of that.
Okay.
That we talked about Bumper Shoot. But do you have any that you're adding?
I have some in my mind. I also don't know how I'm going to find time to do all of this. Like, I clipped for the previous best of each 100. So hopefully I still have those clips and can just do them relatively easily. But not the last 500.
How long are you thinking in minutes? Like,
for this podcast?
Or like segment, like 5-minute segments or something? And are you going like to that. Introduce them?
I think historically I just kind of said the episode number question, you know, such and such.
Okay. That's going to be sometime next week.
Yeah.
I can't believe our 500th episode led up to with everything. Just there's a lot going on in Peltoncast world.
That it timed up with the Super Bowl and the NBA trade deadline, one of the busiest weeks of my year. Yes.
Oh my God. Plus, yeah.
Quite fascinating. So I have a plan for next week's pod. I think we should do, since we've done a Super Bowl preview this week, I think next week, you know what we should do?
What?
Oops, all prop bets.
Okay. That's fun. I like when Bill and Cousin Sal do that. Look through prop bets. Yeah. I think that sounds kind of fun.
So again, if you've made it this far, you must have some thoughts to share with us.
We had a lot of good ones. Like
we have had some good ones. Yeah,
I might even listen to this. I did pull up Luca on. We were driving to Portland on Friday. Oh, this is one other thought that I had. We were driving to Portland on Friday, and on the drive down, I was like, I talked about you and your UW basketball team. We went and listened to that. Children, not interested at all.
Wait, what UW basketball team?
The one that he made in 2K.
Oh, okay. Oh, the children were not interested in hearing you talk about Luca.
I think Luca was like a little interested in it for a second, but they only want to hear their own voices. I will tell you, they've heard enough of me.
So have I.
Okay, trip to Portland very fast. We drove down and back on last Friday night to see Blazers Raptors.
You came like, back night of?
Yeah.
Wow.
Kind of fun. I mean, the game ended real. It was a very fast game. You used to do this all the time.
Yeah, but I wasn't doing it with three small children.
Whatever, they just sleep.
Yeah. Okay.
But
Also,
We
Luka
stopped.
is by no means a small child
I know he's
in
way
zero
too taller
senses.
than both of us.
He walks around with, "I'm just here for Caleb Love's sons."
That was a good one. Also, okay, wait, two things. Jan was like, "What was your favorite part of Portland to the children?" And Luca was like, "The basketball game or whatever." And she's like, "You didn't do anything else." He's like, "We just went to that." Which is annoying because we went to a reptile store beforehand.
I have heard this, yes.
By far the best part of the trip, because the game against the Raptors was bad. Reptile store, excellent experience. Reptiles rule. Hipster reptile store in Portland, 100 out of 100.
What neighborhood is this in?
I was like over by the Doug Fir, like just
Okay.
east.
What was the other takeaway?
So the last time we were at a Blazers game, it was like late December, right? Right before the team from down south was playing against Texas Tech on New Year's Day. Obviously, a lot of gear. This time,
This is when you
after.
were on the Motivision,
Yes.
the Moda boards,
Yes, wearing
repping
the
UW.
dark purple Husky
Yeah.
gear. This time, after an embarrassing loss, many are saying, to Indiana. I will tell you, I did not see a single item of Oregon clothing in the
Wow.
entire house. Like, so we kept looking around because I was telling Mark, I was like, have you noticed that there's no Oregon gear here at all?
He probably hadn't.
No, he wasn't paying any attention. And he was like, what about that one right there? And I was like, boom, Sonics, boom, Sonics, boom, Sonics.
Wow,
Oh,
love
the
it.
Sonics are highly rep. I've never been to a Blazers game that the Sonics were not highly represented at.
I mean, I've definitely always seen some Sonics. I don't know if I would say highly, but you're probably more likely to go to games that people are driving down for.
I mean, I guess
Whereas,
so. I don't know if that Raptors game was like, I think it's just,
it's a Friday night.
yeah.
People are more likely to do that than a Tuesday, which is, it's all the same to me.
I think I might have seen one person with an Oregon hat. And it's like Sonics, there were at least 20 people. So Sonics way better represented. They are down. There's a little bit of Dante Moore's coming back, but the people of Portland at the very least are not that excited about the team. Right now, I could feel it in the fucking air.
Okay.
So that was just a little bit of intel that
Well,
I noticed.
you know
Oh,
what happened to them?
what?
They got their hopes up.
Yeah, that's what I said for them to do. The other thing was they have signs that you can make your like your own personal sign on. State of Washington.
Really?
Yeah, that's what the I'm here for Caleb Love is on. It's on an outline of the state of
I didn't even
Washington.
notice that. Wow, that's cool.
Really makes you think, doesn't it?
Shouts to the
What
Cove.
did I say? Portland, Washington.
On that note,
Thanks for listening.
thanks.